I'd like to try to give you two types of insights tonight. The first of those is an insight into some of the recent work that's been carried out on the origin of us, on the origin of animals as a whole, and some of the exciting developments across disciplines that have been occurring. But I'd also like to give you some insights into what it's like to be doing research in a high polar environment where the weather is often working against you, and often it's a race in terms of time to get the work finished before weather closes in again. And I'd like to choose a couple of areas that I've studied in the past few years, but they also run back through my career. So if one thinks of a modern ecosystem, this is the sort of picture that tends to come to mind. Highly diverse, typically associated with a coral reef, lots of food web interactions, lots of organisms eating other organisms, very dynamic interactions. If one goes back to the period immediately before the origin of animals, it's a very different picture. It's something like this. This is a pre-animal ecosystem. It's a picture of the bottom of a seabed, or it could be. It's actually the bottom of a puddle in the English Lake District, but it serves very well as an illustration of primitive life. The bubbles you can see over here are gas bubbles coming off that bacterial mat, a mat of blue-green bacteria. Decay bubbles underneath the mat are causing these little pustules. And as wind blows across the surface of that ecosystem, it's ripping up flakes. And if one goes back to the period that we call the Neoproterozoic, that's pretty much what one finds. That's all that one finds in terms of organismal interactions. It's a very simple world. So what I would like to do tonight is look at the early transition from this to the rudiments of an animal-based ecosystem, such as the one we saw in the last slide. And to do that, we need to consider the Cambrian explosion. The Cambrian explosion was a time of great dynamic evolutionary activity, and if one leaves aside paleontological obsessions with dinosaurs, it's probably the best known paleobiological example to the general public. The seminal book by Stephen Jay Gould is now almost 20 years old. I don't think we agree with very much that's in there anymore, but it stimulated a huge range of different aspects of research. And there are other deposits that have come on stream since the Burgess Shale was described by Whittington, Conway Morris, and Briggs. One of the premier ones of those is the Chengjiang, and that's been described by Derek Civita from this museum and his brother David, and my old PhD supervisor, Dick Aldridge, who can't be here tonight. And a third one can be added to those, which is the Sirius Passet fauna from North Greenland. And the interesting thing about Sirius Passet and Chengjiang is that both of them are considerably older and nearer to that root of animal evolution than the Burgess Shale is. So to look at the Cambrian explosion requires a really wide range of skills and techniques, certainly so many that no single individual can hope to make an impact. And in a way, the Cambrian explosion is the Higgs boson of paleobiology. It's a problem that we've been working on for decades. We feel we're getting quite close. We're definitely getting some forward momentum, but we're not there yet. And there's more work that needs to be done before we can really understand the complex changes in Earth systems that were occurring at that time. So one of those debates is whether the explosion really is an explosion, or did it start off as a little trickle and then turned into a bang? Is there a deeper root to that Cambrian explosion? If we accept that it's an explosion, or at least there is at some stage a rapid diversification, is that driven by internal animal genomes, or is it driven by extrinsic Earth processes? And there's a very predictable dichotomy that arrives at that point. The earth scientists tend to assume that it's driven by earth processes. The biologists, by and large, tend to assume that it's driven by changes to the genome and changes in developmental pathways. The answer, of course, as with all of those debates, is probably that it's somewhere between the two and that both are involved. So to make any meaningful contribution to the Cambrian explosion as a scientific problem, we need to consider a huge range of scientific disciplines, from developmental genetics and looking at the evolution of organisms using both molecules and their morphology, looking at the timing of those evolutionary events using molecular clocks. We need to look at ecology and the way that ecosystems are engineered by the animals within them, and then a whole range of more geological fields, sedimentary geochemistry, isotope geochemistry, the sediments themselves that the organisms occur in, right down to primary geological mapping, actually mapping out the deposits so that we understand the disposition of the rocks and how the fossils occur in the rocks, the sorts of things that Charles Lapworth pioneered back in the 1800s. For non-geologists in the audience, here's a time scale to hang it all off. We can ignore the first 3.5 billion years of Earth history for this purpose. It's an irrelevance. And we'll pick up the story at 1,000 million years. There's not much happens in this interval either. And then there's a series of really quite interesting events in this period called the Cryogenian, and the name is no accident. The first animals appear, the first indirect evidence do occur in the Cryogenian. There's some fossil evidence, much disputed, a little bit younger, that Martin Brazier in Earth Sciences has worked on. And then the first definite evidence occurs in this period, the Ediacaran. The events to which I was alluding in the Cryogenian are a series of major glacial events. And we need to factor that in. They seem to coincide with the first appearance of animals, but is that a coincidence or is it really driving the evolution of animals? So throughout Earth history up until that point, we'd either had just simple bacteria, prokaryotes, or we'd had single cells with a nucleus. And what we want to focus on tonight is the evolution of organisms that have a multicellular organization. And in particular, amongst those groups, the plants, the fungi, and the animals, focus in on the animals. This is a very busy slide, but it's summarized on here. Here's the very first physical evidence and geochemical evidence of bacteria. And this top line tracks the growth in maximum organism size on a logarithmic scale. Starting off at a bacterial size, there's a big leap when we come to cells with a nucleus because they've got to squeeze the nucleus and all the genetic information in the nucleus into the cell. And then it ramps up as we come through to the first animals. And then eventually plants take over as the largest organisms. So there's this general trend with steps towards increased maximum organism size. Photosynthesis appears as those cells capture symbionts that can do the photosynthesis. And then there's a flood of events that's associated with this massive increase in diversity. And that's what we're looking at tonight. We're looking at that line there. There are a few precursors, the so-called Ediacaran fossils that we don't really understand very well, but they're either distantly related to animals or they're not animals at all. And then, at first with a trickle and then with a flood, come the animals. These are the Ediacaran organisms. This is what happened before those ice ages, those glacial events. These are the organisms that appeared afterwards, very simple, living on still on a microbial mat. And then we get the blossoming of the first animals. Some people have attributed it to glaciation. Others have looked at the geochemical evidence for a significant rise in oxygen levels post those glaciations. And if you look, the key line to focus on here is this top bar. After the last of those glaciations, we begin to get free oxygen in the deep oceans. And that's probably because so much oxygen is being produced that it can't be bound in through the oxidation of organic matter, and it can't be bound in through the oxidation of iron, and it then becomes free and available in the deep oceans, as well as the surface oceans where it's been present for a longer period. Is the origin of oxygen the key trigger to the evolution of animals? A lot of people think so, but is it that simple? The last of the really busy diagrams. This is a key paper that came out in Science last year. It's two diagrams in one. If one reads it as a histogram, we have along the bottom the number of major groups of organisms, major groups of animals. And here we have those strange Ediacaran organisms that we'll classify in green as something not quite animal. But then you see the explosive increase in steps of animal diversity. And this is animal diversity in terms of major types of animals, not just individual species. So there is an initial fuse, but then there are some big jumps in this histogram. So there does seem to be something that's happening in terms of the overall ecosystems and environment that's enabling that diversification. If we then look at the tree, we can see that these places where the tree branches record evolutionary events defining the origin of those major animal groups. And we can see that although there are a few deep ones around the period of the glaciation, that's the older glaciation, that's the younger, and then that's the last one, there are sporadic occurrences. So we would predict, for example, that there should have been fossil corals or the precursors of fossil corals down at that level. But the majority of diversification is sitting up at this higher level, notwithstanding some deep divergences for which, as yet, we have no fossil evidence. In other words, there seem to be two different events going on here. There seem to be some deep evolutionary divergences, deep evolutionary events, but there seems to be something else controlling the major radiation of animal forms at a lower level, and that's what we want to focus on tonight. The final context is that one needs to understand where the continents were. The plate tectonic arrangements of the continents was very different. And if one plots the Burgess Shale, Sirius Passet, and Chengjiang, they're temptingly tropical. And there's at least a suspicion, though it needs a lot more work on it, that the main locus of animal evolution might have been in subtropical environments. It's entirely coincidental, and to my benefit, that these areas have then flung their way to the North Pole and presented themselves in nice cold environments to work on them. So what about field work in the high polar regions? The two areas that I'd like to mention tonight are Sirius Passet itself, and then as an initial context, some work that we did on an island about two-thirds of the way up the east coast called Ellerö this summer. Focusing in on that east coast, this is taken just after we left, and this is the island of Ellerö at about 73 degrees north. To get there involves landing at an old airstrip at a mining settlement down here, and then on an expensive expedition, a helicopter or a twin-engine plane, or if doing it the cheap way, an inflatable boat. The distances are deceptive. That's 120 kilometers or so. So this summer was definitely the cheap way. We arrived, inflated the boats, discovered that they had multiple leaks, reinflated them, secured some more of the leaks, and on and on, and then put everything into the boats and set off. And it's no mean feat getting six big geologists and a ton of equipment into a series of inflatable boats. The survival suits are not for fun, although there were people sunbathing in bikinis just to the right of this, hardy Norwegians, I would hasten to add. The water we measured at -2, so falling overboard is not something to be recommended. So it was an exciting and choppy ride north in the inflatables, taking much longer than we expected, crawling up the coast, really. And it's not a bad way to do field work. It's certainly very cheap. And at its best, you're planing along a mirror-calm fjord with icebergs in the background and wonderful geology on the south coast of Ella, and life couldn't be better. An expedition with the same people a few years ago shows the flip side of that, which was a shipwreck at 80-odd degrees north in Spitsbergen, and that's us leaving the boat as it sank with all of our samples. So it's not an environment to be taken lightly. This is the less cheap way of getting there, and the only way to get into some of the expensive areas. And that's why Sirius Passet is so little understood. It's right on the north coast, and getting there is fiendishly difficult and highly expensive. Once there, the only way forward is camping and in an exquisite environment. And these are the rocks that we were looking at, and this is the context that I'd like to examine for those pre-animal ecosystems. So if we take the tent away and focus on something geological instead, this is the equivalent of that muddy puddle in the Lake District that I showed you. This is a microbial mat ecosystem down in the Neoproterozoic prior to those glacial events. And in the absence of animal grazing, those microbial mats do very different things. They grow into miniature reefs. They grow as sheets of sediment that simply can't occur at the modern day because the gastropods simply graze them away as quickly as they can grow. So this sort of ecosystem dies off almost immediately that gastropods appear in the fossil record. Gastropods are very fiendish. If we zoom in, you can see these pillars of individual microbial mats growing upwards, trying to capture the light, so that the shape of these colonies is entirely driven by them fighting for available light resources and then being modified by wave action around them. There's not much else that controls them, a little bit of water geochemistry. And then we can see what happens next. The platform, and you might imagine an environment a little bit like the modern Bahamas, so knee-deep water, really quite warm. And then the platform is buried under lots of deep water sediments. And the first of the glaciations comes in. That's the first of our glacial tillites, and the second one is this red bed up here. And there's no doubt that these are glacial. They have all the features of a modern glacial deposit, and we have glaciologists with us this summer looking in more detail at those, project led by Ian Fairchild, who's in the audience. So that microbial ecosystem is killed off by the glacial events. It disappears instantaneously. It does come back, but when it comes back, it begins to come back with evidence for animals. These glacial events are often referred to as snowball earth events, and they're an entire lecture and series of lectures in their own right, and there's not time to go into them tonight, but it's quite possible that the entire globe was glaciated from pole to equator at certain times during these intervals. The extent of glaciation is debated. It might have been slushy around the equator, but nonetheless, the entire planet, to all intents and purposes, froze up. And that unfreezing is a key event, both in the history of the planet, but also potentially in the history of animals. If we look at the evolution of animals and that transition through from microbial mats, perhaps with a little smattering of these Ediacaran fossils of enigmatic affinity, right the way through, fast-forwarding to pretty modern marine ecosystems, we can see a series of transitions. This is the key one that we're looking at. It's the change from what we call mat grounds to complex interactions. We begin to get predators, we begin to get food chains, we begin to get organisms burrowing into the substrate because they have the ecological and physiological capacity, probably through the evolution of peristaltic motion, to excavate burrows and live in them and use them for feeding. Then later on, we get the explosion into the water column. There's a primitive necton, as we call it, free-swimming fauna, but it's pretty restricted in the Cambrian. Look at it a different way, and we can look at the evolution of skeletons, and we get the same picture. We get a sudden appearance of lots of different skeletal types. In all of these groups, all of the colored bars record the first appearance of skeletonization. And the color of the bars is the mineral that they were using to form those skeletons. So blue is calcite, red is silica, and in our own phylum, green is calcium phosphate, the apatite that we make our bones with. So for some reason, all these organisms were evolving skeletons at the same time using different minerals, biominerals. So what's happening in terms of ocean geochemistry to trigger that? Food webs get much more complex, and this is an attempt at recreating one of those early food webs. If we look at the organisms that are burrowing into sediment, we see a dramatic change across the boundary as well. And that's producing a major change, because what it's doing is introducing oxygen below the sediment-water interface. During the periods of those mat grounds, everything beneath the seabed was essentially anoxic and couldn't support life. As soon as some organisms begin to pierce those mats, they introduce free oxygen. And then, through a process of feedback, more organisms can move in, and we get this radiation of burrowing organisms below into the substrate. So what about the Sirius Passet largostata, as we call it, itself? Largostata is simply the word that a paleontologist uses for an exceptional fossil deposit, either through concentration, lots of fossils, or through quality of preservation. And in this case, it's very much quality as well as quantity. So this is the environment. It's right up in the far north. So if we look at a different perspective of the globe, we are sitting now looking at a fjord out into the Arctic Ocean at 83 degrees north. Sirius Passet itself is in an ice-free area. The geologists go for the ice-free bits around the edges, of course. And it was first discovered on a mapping expedition, my first trip to Greenland in 1984, actually. Fossils were collected by geologists, but not really understanding the significance. And it was only when it was discovered that they had organisms very similar to the Burgess Shale on the slabs that had been brought back when they were looked at under a microscope. And the first expedition up to collect went up in 1989. Simon Conway Morris there collecting on the Scree and John Peel. And I was lucky enough to be on that first collecting expedition in 1989. And it was probably the hardest trip I've ever done. Probably couldn't do it now, actually. It involved landing the Twin Otter on a completely unprepared piece of tundra. This is simply a hillside. There's actually quite a slope on that photograph, taking the risk that it wouldn't sink in or hit anything. We then had to carry the camp, the equipment, all the food, about 10 or 12 kilometers across the tundra, across some pretty big rivers, a younger and fitter version of me. And we really are as tired as we look, as we had these purpose-designed tundra trolleys to ferry the food backwards and forwards. And then, once we got to the campsite, we constructed an airstrip so that the plane could come in and get us out again, because it wouldn't be able to land and pick up a load. That airstrip came in quite useful, because it now means that we can go in and land a twin otter there. And this is the recent work that we did in 2009 and 2011. And you've no idea how much pleasure it gives a geologist to say that their fieldwork has been sponsored by Carlsberg. but also substantially funded by the Agron Institute and the Royal Society. It's still an interesting experience. This is twin otter business class. And this is one of my colleagues, and later me, trying to guide the pilot in to find the airstrip, because it's a very small airstrip and it's very difficult to spot. And you might also notice that as the pilot tries to find the airstrip, he's definitely looking at Jakob rather than the airstrip ahead of him. And that's what he's trying to find. It really is just a very simple strip with some big cracks. So but the geology itself is accessed from a camp that's about 500 meters below the locality. At its best, it's idyllic. You can't see the mosquitoes, but it's reasonably idyllic. But at 83 degrees north, it's capricious as well, and it can flip from one to the other pretty quickly. At the locality, the myth had grown through the early expeditions that one could only find the fossils in the Scree. because it needed weathering to bring out the features of the fossils. And one of the things we were keen to do in 2009 was test that. So we found the bedded rock that the fossils were coming from. And actually, within 20 minutes, we were finding very large slabs with lots of fossils on them. And that has been a big breakthrough in our understanding of this remote locality. So it's a matter of simply sitting there, hammering and hammering and hammering. And I've never prided myself as a fossil collector, or I've even taken much interest, which is acutely ironic for a paleontologist, I understand. But it was simply chain gang labor, really, for all the time that we were there. And we collected, the first expedition, about a ton and a half of rock that we carried down the hill. It's not possible to mention Sirius Passet without thinking about climate change, actually. On that first expedition in 1989, it was like Narnia. We landed and it was 50% covered by snow patches and permanent ice. Working at the locality, this is Simon Conway Morris again, was underneath this big ice cliff with bits falling off. Fast forward to 2009, just 20 years later, and 2011, and this is the locality. It's grass covered, there's no snow and ice, it could be Wyoming. And the equivalent photograph of that is now this rather grassy little terrace. If one takes a more aerial view of the region, the locality is that black white line there in the distance. This flat frozen fjord, no icebergs, no sign of melting at all. Later in the season, just begins to melt back a little bit, but puddles on the surface. The recent expeditions, completely open water, and the fjord breaking up as we left. And a few weeks after we left, there was completely open water all around the north coast of Greenland. Radiocarbon dating suggests that that's the first time in 8,000 years that that's happened. So if anyone told you that global warming doesn't exist, question them. In terms of the geology, Sirius Passet sits at this very interesting boundary on a geological map between pale blue and dark blue. The pale blue are limestones of Bahamas type, very shallow water. And the dark blue is a deep water basin. And the Sirius Passet locality sits right at that boundary between the two, right on the edge of the shelf of the carbonate platform, as we call it. And you can see that close in. This is the fjord that we've just looked at from the air. The dark colors are the purples are the shelf carbonates and the sediments that overlie them, the mudstones. And here are the deep water basins. So already we know that we're at quite an interesting junction between deep and shallow water. And that's brought out on this map as well. And there's now, for the geologists in the audience, a substantial fault line that runs along that platform front, that's guided by that platform front. And in cross-section, this takes a little bit of time to absorb, but what we've done here is taken multiple sections cut through the geology of that map and linked them together as a series of fences. And so here we're looking from south to north, and the area that we are interested in is this junction between yellow sandstones sitting on the shelf and black, deeper water mudstones sitting just off the shelf at the top of the continental slope going down into that deep water basin. And Sirius Passet sits right at that boundary, just into the black. So it's at a major geological transition. A close-in geological map shows that locality one is where we were collecting, and we've got this interesting juxtaposition of older limestones, the brown mudstones that the fossils occur in, and then these green sandstones. So in terms of the last diagram, these are the yellow sandstones of the last diagram, and this is the start of the black mudstone. So it's a really interesting environmental transition. The fossils themselves are exquisite, and these hadn't been found when people were simply collecting in the scree. It was only when we began to hammer open slabs that we began to see these big, complete arthropods. That notebook is 20 centimeters high. We were also sponsored by Moleskine. So the large arthropod was known in bits from Sirius Passet, but not as complete specimens. And so we've begun to get a lot more biological information out about these arthropods. The reconstruction of organismal anatomy from very flattened fossils, mere squidges on a bedding plane, takes a lot of skill and practice, and really years of experience. And eventually one can build anatomically correct models like these, which really bring the organism to life. These would be most closely related to the modern water bears, the tardigrades. But they're huge. They're tens and tens of centimeters long. And they were probably deposit feeding around the Sirius Passet environment. And probably not actually, despite this reconstruction, doing too much swimming. These are reconstructions of two of the other iconic organisms. This is a Burgess Shale organism. We saw it as well. We saw it on the cover, or covers of some versions of Wonderful Life. This is the killer whale of the Cambrian, an arthropod, a free-swimming arthropod that was over a meter long, a mouth of peculiar construction that looks like an old-fashioned camera diaphragm, and sliced it its way through prey. A cigar cutter, I suppose, would be the other way of looking at it. And we've not yet got complete ones, but we do have these grasping, these raptorial appendages at the front. And this is the iconic organism from Sirius Passet, and actually the very first fossil that we found on the very first day of the first expedition. It's been much debated, and it sits at a really interesting point in animal evolution. It's become quite iconic of the deposit itself. This is a photograph of that first specimen that we found. And the Greenlanders, very proud of their geological heritage and their fossil heritage, even put it on their 1 krona stamp. Simplifying this language on the right, the most likely possibility is that it's a very, very primitive mollusk, but that it belongs in the general group of modern mollusks. In other words, these fossils can really begin to inform our understanding of the early evolution of modern groups, and that really is the bottom line of why it's so important to document these localities. Because we can begin to look at organisms like this, a group, an obscure group, truly obscure group, called the Vetulicolians, which Derek and David Siviter have described from the Chenjiang in China, and this is the first of many hundreds of specimens we found from Sirius Passet. Fossils of this type always look much clearer when they've been drawn up as a camera lucida drawing, and even clearer when they've been reconstructed into models or drawn reconstructions, even if this one does look a little bit like a collapsed airbed. So what's significant about this organism? Well, the significant thing about it is that it's got a real mishmash of characters. It's got a big bag-like body at the front, and it's got these gill slits. And then it's got a flexible tail that's capable of propulsion by side-to-side beating. There aren't many organisms that possess both gill slits and that beating tail. At first, it looks a bit like an arthropod. And that's how it was first described. But probably it isn't. And we're now pretty sure that it leads us in a different direction. If we look at our near relatives, and you might not necessarily want to think of them as your near relatives, we are sitting here in a sort of hegemonic right-hand position on the cladogram. Our nearest relatives are the sea squirts, the tunicates, which are basically crisp bags that suck and blow. They're very primitive organisms. The simple filter-feeding cephalochordates. And then our next nearest group are the echinoderms and the acorn worms. All of these, at least in primitive states, are united by having gill slits. And in more evolved forms, certainly have a tail that's capable of propulsion. So it seems that the Vetulicolians are probably telling us something about the origin of our own group, the deuterostomes. So deuterostomes are this large group of animals that form part of the animal kingdom, and the other part of the animal kingdom are the protostomes. The thing that divides us from the protostomes is that if we go from the stage of a sphere of cells, as they develop, they indent, forming the so-called blastopore. That indentation goes through the cells anchored to the other side to form a tube, So we've turned a sphere into a donut. And if the initial indentation in that to form that donut forms the anus, then it's a deuterostome. If it forms the mouth, it's a protostome. And so all of those organisms are united by having a presumptive anus. And if we, this is a very technical diagram, but if we look at all of the characters, it shows us that vetulicolians are probably sitting either somewhere immediately before the chordate or right down at the base of the tree. And that debate is ongoing, and we're looking at more material at the moment. What molecular studies of living organisms can do is tell us the branching pattern of these major groups. But what the molecular evolutionary studies can't tell us is the sequence of detailed acquisition of characters down at the base of the tree. And using that combination of molecular techniques to get the tree pattern and paleontological techniques to map out the detailed acquisition of characters in combination, not trying to fight one against the other, is a really powerful approach to understanding the early evolution of animal groups. I want to focus for the last few minutes on the environment and what that tells us about this major change in ecosystems. So this is sitting, hammering away for week after week. On a measured basis, we will prise a block out, we dissect it with hammers, if you can dissect anything with a hammer, and record in detail what level it was coming from, so we knew the changes up the section. The sedimentology is quite simple in many ways. We go from thickly bedded mudstones to much more finely bedded mudstones, completely uninterrupted laminations. The exceptional preservation comes in fits and starts, and seems to coincide with periods when there's virtually no bioturbation at all. And that's probably telling us that there are very low oxygen levels, and initial geochemistry backs that up. Occasionally, this phrase BST films tells us that we're getting Burgess Shale quality of preservation as well, this very delicate reproduction of anatomical detail. So we've got big, smooth bedding surfaces, thin bedding, absence of vertical burrows or bioturbation. The previously collected fauna, that fauna collected only from the scree, was only collected at the partings, at the boundaries between these individual beds. And that's of interest, because it's a very biased representation of the fauna, as it turns out. So altogether, we think that these are little event beds. Each little bed represents a separate event within that depositional environment. And actually, we think they're little storm events. They're not above storm wave base. These are storms that are occurring on that carbonate shelf or the sandstone shelf that succeeded it, and they're spilling sediment down below the depths to which storm waves reach, and that's where our fauna is accumulating and living. There are two distinct faunas. There's the one living on those microbial mats, those very smooth surfaces, and that's the fauna that, for the most part, was described in the early visits, those halkyriids, some sponges, so something grazing, something sitting there filter feeding, one of those tardigrade-like animals, again, probably deposit feeding or grazing, and the big arthropods that we subsequently found, all associated on that microbial mat. Whenever one of those big arthropods dies, it seems to have been like a whale carcass on the modern ocean floor. They pile in and begin to excavate the carcass. They're after any nutrients, and that suggests that environment is probably rather nutrient poor. This is a paper that we've just had out in Geology over the summer. And there's also some limited evidence that whatever organism was making these was actually farming bacteria underneath the carcass. This is one of the earliest examples of bacterial farming by animals. And these sorts of patterns of burrows are not very common, but they're very characteristic of those habits in the modern day. If one hammers open those slabs, rather than simply collecting them off the scree, that's where, at the right interval, the Burgess Shale fauna pops out. And all of the things that it was thought that Sirius Passet lacked are there when you hammer. It does beg the question of why the initial explorers didn't hammer, but that's the way that myths develop and propagate. So the worms, so these are the relatives of the earthworms, our vetulicolians that we just discussed, that big anomalocaris, the arm of that, and various characteristic worm groups that are characteristic of the Burgess Shale. So all of a sudden, we do have that Burgess Shale quality of preservation. And the style of preservation is really different between the two groups. On the microbial mats, it's rather 3D, it's pretty low quality. We don't get really genuine soft tissues, the sort of tissues like skin that decay very quickly, what we call labile soft tissues. And there are no size limits on preservation. If we go to the Burgess Shale style preservation, it's much more delicate, anatomically detailed preservation by carbonized films and by clay templates over those carbonized films. So suggest that there's something quite different between those two faunas. The early workers on the Sirius Passet, John Peel and Simon Conway Morris, had a distinctive interpretation of the relationship of the Sirius Passet locality to that geological setting that we described earlier. So these are the carbonates, the limestones, and they interpret this as a genuine edge of the carbonate platform, a real escarpment. The sort of escarpment, if you stand on the edge of the Bahamas, you see the deep water beneath you, and at the tongue of the ocean, and it's a really abrupt escarpment. And they thought that the Sirius Passet fauna was living at the base of that escarpment in mudstones heaped up against the escarpment edge. There's a reason that they thought that, because that's the old interpretation of the Burgess Shale. And they've been very strongly inspired by looking at the interpretation of the Burgess Shale sitting here and beneath this large escarpment edge with various elements of the fauna either swimming or burrowing or living just underneath that escarpment edge. And you can see in this Danish diagram that really was the sort of model they were expecting. We think it's completely wrong, actually, and that's led them astray in their overall environmental interpretation. This is a geological fault. It's not anything to do with an original depositional escarpment. And that sounds like a detail, but it's a really important detail when we're trying to pin down the environment of this animal, this radiation of animal ecosystems. And the evidence for that is that if one looks in detail at the way up of these sediments, the limestones are the correct way up. They're younging upwards. All of the sediments of the Sirius Passet formation are actually upside down. And it's impossible to do that for these to be getting younger as one goes in towards the escarpment edge, if that isn't a geological fault. We actually think that this is another geological fault as well. So we're dealing with something that's in a fault sliver rather than that original setting proposed by Ineson and Peel. So if that's a later geological artifact, what's the real setting? And I think that the real setting is visible around the corner, where we see the top of that carbonate platform with the mudstones of Sirius Passet sitting directly on top. And the evidence that this is a sedimentary contact is that there's all sorts of clints and grikes, classical Yorkshire Dales limestone scenery. So this carbonate platform has been emergent. It's been eroded by the rain to form clints and grikes. They've been filled with the early sediments associated with Sirius Passet, and then the Sirius Passet has been laid down on top. So we can move away from that escarpment there. And pull together all those strands of evidence so that we can begin to piece together the environment that Sirius Passet was in. So we know that there was a mat dwelling, there were microbial mats with a fauna living on top of them. Vagile epibenthic detritivores, in case you were wondering, are simply animals that swim, living on the sediment surface and eating detritus. Never hide behind Latin, I suppose. And the grazers of those microbial mats. Those microbial mats were periodically buried by storm events that brought in the Burgess Shale elements of the fauna. And that explains the different depositional styles. All the elements are articulated. We're not dealing with bits of skeletons. All of the organisms are in one piece, more or less. So we're not transporting them very far. We're transporting them alive in all probability. And we've got shreds of what we think are green algae. So they're coming from the photic zone. They're not coming from very deep water. Put all that together, and we can begin to build up the sort of environmental diagram much beloved of geologists. So starting at the shoreline over on the left, we've got really high energy deposits associated with waves pounding onto that shore face. Move a little bit further out, and we've got a few burrows, the sorts of burrows that you see if you go up and look at the Cambrian sediments around Ullapool in northwest Scotland. Then we go into below the Fairweather wave base, so the area, the level below which waves normally penetrate, and mud begins to accumulate. And then we go down below storm wave base, the level at which storms reach. And sitting just below that level are those mat grounds of the Sirius Passet fauna. And we would speculate that the Burgess shale elements have been brought in from just a little bit further up the shelf. Why does that matter? Well, it brings us back to that oxygen debate, actually. If oxygen is so important, why are these earliest animal ecosystems sitting so far out on the shelf? Because if one looked at the oxygen supply, they're not living in an area where there's no oxygen, but it's certainly not the area where the oxygen is highest. That would be up on the shore face. Similarly, nutrients will be being generated in the photic zone. And down here, there will be relatively small amounts of nutrients being transported. So it's not the nutrient supply per se that's controlling their distribution, though obviously they need some nutrients. If one looks at sediment and substrate mobility, how much is that sediment moving around? Then I think that's the key factor. It's probable that these early groups were not very tolerant, as many modern groups are. Think back to that very first slide of a reef ecosystem, of high energy environments, lots of sediment moving around. And actually, the only place they could establish themselves is deep water. And so, although oxygen might have been responsible for getting the whole process kick-started, it seems that in terms of the origin of animal ecosystems, it's very much restricted by how much the sediment moves around, which is good news for sedimentologists. So, pulling all that together, we can say that the origin of animal phyla coincides with deglaciation, the end of those snorkel earth events, and a rise in oceanic oxygenation. Those two things might actually be linked as well, but that's beyond the remit of this lecture. But the diversification itself doesn't coincide with those. There's a slow fuse of animal evolution, but the main diversification is later. We do know that the continents were flooded at the base of the Cambrian. That's a major event, and it was the first time it had happened for about 500 million years. The continents have been eroded to surfaces that would have resembled billiard tables. They were that flat, smooth, no hills, nothing. So a small sea level rise would flood an awful lot of continent. There's evidence that we don't need to go into the detail of, but a lot of geochemical evidence that inundation of large areas of continent resulted in enhanced continental erosion, and a number of geochemical indicators suggest that. One of those is that there's a big rise in the availability of calcium derived from weathered rocks. So does that actually drive the origin, the multiple convergent origin of skeletal biomineralization? Is it that sudden flood of available calcium that triggers the origin of biomineralization in lots of different groups simultaneously? Initially using it as a calcium sink because calcium is toxic to cells. The flooding of the continent would also generate large areas of relatively shallow water, and some classical experiments in ecology decades ago showed that total diversity that can be sustained is relative to the total area of habitat available. So the so-called species area effect might in itself, the sudden availability of large areas of habitat may itself be a driver. So Sirius Passet provides us an important insight into that. The origin of Cambrian ecosystems may well lie in this rather low energy outer shelf setting, not in the area of highest oxygen supply. That has some important implications in terms of what's happening in the inner shelf, and it's only certain types of organisms that could really evolve and adapt quickly to those environments that can survive there. And we still get those Ediacaran-style microbial mat ecosystems that have persisted for 3 billion years out in the furthest reaches of the shelf below the storm wave base. So I would argue that at least in terms of the diversification within animal ecosystems, it was sea level what done it. And that although the rise in available oxygen is important, it's not the main driver of that initial diversification. Thanks very much.